It's Light the Tower, your daily look around the world of sports with Hall of Fame broadcaster and voice of the Texas Longhorns, Craig Way.
Say goodnight to this one!
And Horns 24/7 insider, Jeff Howe. On your live, local, and independent home for sports talk in Austin, The Horn.
Second hour of Light to Tower here on the Horn. Craig and Jeff with you. And we've got special guests coming up bottom of the hour. Chris Hummer, 24/7 Sports, will join us. You say he's got a real big breakdown on all of this, right?
Yeah, the development rate story. We talked a little bit about that in the first hour. I will have Chris go over all the nuts and bolts of it when we have him on at the bottom of the hour.
Okay, all right. So,
People have said they've had trouble hearing me, Craig. I think it's because my voice drops as I finish speaking, when I finish a sentence. So
do you turn into a low talker at the tail end of sentences?
I do, yeah, so I'll just try to not do that.
Okay, all right. He'll try to make sure he doesn't.
Or I can just yell the whole show and make sure everybody hears me.
Make sure everybody hears me! That's stupid.
I don't think anybody has trouble hearing you, Snoop. I think it works out.
I'm like the opposite of Gus Johnson. Gus, what Snoop just did, that's Gus Johnson for everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
It is.
To update you on the one regional baseball game still going on, Old Dominion and Virginia, both which are located in the state of Virginia, University of Virginia's in Charlottesville, Old Dominion's in Norfolk, and that's why they're playing in Columbia, right, in South Carolina. Anyway, they're 2-2 in the top of the eighth. Old Dominion has just tied it with a run in the top of the eighth inning. So the winner of that regional is going to play Dallas Baptist in a super regional there in Columbia because it's one of the 16 NCAA-approved regional host sites. It could also host a super regional because it's gone through all the protocols and the testing and all that other kind of stuff. That's why neither side will host. We do know the Texas Longhorns will be hosting their super regional, and we know that they're going to be taking on the Bulls of the University of South Florida. And that'll be Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, in case you didn't hear. Saturday evening, 8 o'clock, Saturday night at 8, and you can hear on the horn, 7:45, with the airtime and the first pitch at 8 o'clock. Sunday, also 8 o'clock, Sunday night. It's listed, by the way, for those of you who want to know the TV arrangements, that it's listed as being on ESPNU Saturday night, and then either ESPN2 or ESPNU on Sunday night, also at 8. And then if there's an if necessary third game, it would be Monday, either at 3 or 6, either on ESPN2 or ESPNU. Of course, we'll have all the games for you here on the Horn, 7:45 Saturday night, 7:45 Sunday night, and then if necessary, either 2:45 or 5:45. It'll either be 3 or 6 o'clock on that. So anyway, there's that's where that's happening. And then the super regionals are all Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, or Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Half the field will be Friday through Sunday, and half will be Saturday through Monday. By the way, Old Dominion, oh my goodness, almost had a safe at the plate hurtling over the catcher. But Old Dominion did score a run, and they're now up 3-2, and they're going to the bottom of the eighth inning of that one. They had a base hit with two outs and the bases loaded there. So the Friday, Sunday super regionals are number one seed Arkansas against North Carolina State in Fayetteville. Number four seed, well, that matches up with the one in Lubbock, Texas Tech, the eight seed against Stanford, the nine seed. And all three of those games in Lubbock, by the way, are middle of the afternoon, Jeff Howe.
Well, that should be lovely. How about your weather shift from Palo Alto this time of year to Lubbock?
To Lubbock.
2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah. 2 o'clock Friday afternoon. 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon. And then 2 o'clock if necessary, Sunday afternoon.
Sounds like crotch rots in the forecast in Lubbock this weekend.
So there you are. All right, so there's your that on that side. Also on that side of the bracket, the 4 seed Vanderbilt against East Carolina Friday through Sunday, and the 5 seed Arizona against the 12 seed Ole Miss. That is a Friday through Sunday. The Saturday, Monday, Texas, South Florida, Saturday night at 8, Sunday night at 8, and then Monday afternoon at 3 or at 6 if necessary. And the winner of that Super Regional would match up with the winner of the Super Regional going on in Starkville, Mississippi. That would be the first matchup in Omaha, for those of you wanting to know. The 7 seed Mississippi State hosting the 10 seed Notre Dame. And they're Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Saturday afternoon at 1, 5 o'clock Sunday afternoon, 6 o'clock if necessary Monday night. So that's how those two would align on that side of the bracket in Omaha. Along with Tennessee, the 3 seed against LSU, as Paul Maneri keeps his coaching career in Baton Rouge going. That's Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And then Dallas Baptist against the winner of this game going on right now, that's going to the bottom of the 8th with Old Dominion now up on Virginia, 3-2 in the bottom of the 8th. And that Super Regional will take place in Columbia on that. And that would be at 11 a.m. Saturday, 11 a.m. Sunday, and noon if necessary Monday.
So I forgot what I was going to say. I'm sorry.
I thought you were about to say something really pithy there for a moment.
I just got distracted.
Oh, sorry. That's okay. All right. Somebody asked him the question, do the Super Regionals line up with the College World Series bracket? Yes. That's what I was just talking about. I'm asking, do we know right now if Texas wins which College World Series game they play in first? Don't know the time on that, but historically, now again, this is a, for unfortunate reasons, a historic year coming off a really historic year last year, 2020, in that things are different. For example, as we've been saying, the winner of this Virginia Old Dominion game is going to play Dallas Baptist in Columbia. There will not be a team hosting the other. Now, here's a bit of irony for you, Jeff. Old Dominion's never been to a Super Regional. So if they do win, it guarantees a first-time ever team in Omaha because they'll play Dallas Baptist, who's never made it to the College World Series. DBU has made it to one Super Regional. It was 10 years ago. In 2011, Dallas Baptist won this bizarre regional down at Rice, hosted by Rice. And they won the one in Fort Worth, and they matched up with Cal, who won this bizarre regional at Rice. Baylor was in it. Baylor had a big lead, and then it got away from them. Rice was in it. They had all kinds of rain, and Cal won it. So Cal got ready to play Dallas Baptist, and neither side had a ballpark at the time that was suitable for hosting a Super Regional. First of all, Cal had no lights at theirs.
Oh, wow.
And they've since made improvements to it, because I remember going out there and doing the season opener in 2014 when Zane Gerwitz was a freshman. And I always remember that when going out there at the time, and they just put lights up where it was up. It hadn't been up long. But in Dallas Baptist, their facilities weren't up completely to par. So Dallas Baptist.
This was before Fish in the Outfield.
Before Fish in the Outfield. Okay. It was 4 years before Fish in the Outfield when Texas played there in 2015. It was. Which another aside, by the way, it was interesting to hear the triple option guys, RBKD. And here's Brad Kellner the other day saying he didn't realize VCU had a baseball program. I'm like, dude, they were in that regional at Dallas Baptist in 15 that had all the flooding. They were the 4 seed and they won that regional. Texas lost a heartbreaker to Oregon State on Friday and then got eliminated on Saturday, or Sunday. They got rained out on Saturday, and they got eliminated on Sunday by Dallas Baptist. And all the rains and the flooding from the creek came up, and, you know, Colin Shaw finding a fish in the outfield that had washed in from the creek, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, but 4 years prior to that, in 2011, Dallas Baptist gets to a Super Regional. They were a 2 seed. Cal was a 3 seed. Or they both were the same. They were either both 2s or both 3s.
Right.
And Dallas Baptist really tried to find a place to play that Super Regional. They tried for the independent minor league ballpark in Grand Prairie. It was booked. Then they tried for something else, and it was booked. And then they were looking, and they couldn't get into Fort Worth and all this stuff. And the Rangers ballpark was booked. Cal ended up being awarded the Super Regional, which they played at Santa Clara. Because they had a nice little ballpark. It was only 2,500 seats, but it was a little well-lit and all that. Cal hosted that Super Regional, and they won and went to College World Series where they beat Texas A&M there in Omaha. But so this will be the second time the Dallas Baptist has gone to Super Regional and the second time that DBU has had to play in a kind of bizarre
neutral
quasi-neutral site. This will be a true neutral, either Virginia or Old Dominion. I would say the winner of this Virginia-ODU game might have a little bit of a familiarity advantage since they've been playing there the whole weekend, but still it's not their home ballpark. And Old Dominion is kind of a weird story anyway, Jeff. They're a one seed on the road, which doesn't happen often. It has happened before, but it doesn't happen often. They didn't submit a bid because their whole facilities and everything wasn't up to what would have been able to host a regional and or super regional if they win. And then on top of that, they're in Conference USA. That Conference USA tournament was down in Ruston, Louisiana. And so they had a long bus ride to go back to Norfolk, Virginia. And they told this story on the telecast that the team actually watched the selection show in a Burger King parking lot.
Nice.
Because they didn't have enough Wi-Fi on the bus to be able to. And then they had that.
Wasn't a Burger King bathroom, was it?
Wasn't a Burger King bathroom. And they had no chicken whoppers there.
It's got to make sure nobody's getting busy in the Burger King bathroom.
They
right,
were not,
right,
getting, Snoop? Not getting busy in the Burger King bathroom.
Hey, rest in peace, Humpty Hump.
Yeah. So it was just in the Burger King parking lot. That's where they saw that they would be a one seed on the road.
I'll be back in the Burger King parking lot when they bring the chicken whopper back, but until then,
Jeff is checked out on it. So anyway, that's what's meant by these bizarre circumstances.
Right.
And now, you know, Dallas Baptist, DBU, will be taking on ODU if they hold on and win. But right now, Virginia has the tying run aboard with one out in the bottom of the eighth. So we'll keep you posted on that.
And real quick, before we get to our fun fact of the day,
yes,
we are 88 days until kickoff.
Yep.
Snoop, I'm going to bring you in for this. Snoop, you follow NBA Twitter a lot? You pay attention?
Yeah, I guess
to
so, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Is Kevin Durant's bald spot a thing that gets brought up on NBA Twitter?
Not as much as LeBron's.
I know LeBron's is a focal point
people
of discussion.
Don't lean on KD is more because of his waves. He has weird waves at the
because
front, but
you know
they don't
decided a few years ago just to say screw it and just go full on shaving the head all the time, because if it grows out, like, I don't grow hair on the top of my head anymore, so I get, like, you know, the horseshoe going on, so I don't like that, so I just shave it. I don't know what KD needs to do, but, man, I just was looking at some highlights on the TV over your shoulder, Craig.
Yeah. Yes?
The bald spot KD's got going on, you might want to do something about that.
Did LeBron do anything about his?
He's gotten work. Yeah, he gets, like, surgery.
He's a little Propecia working or something.
Yeah, something. I don't know.
Towards Manu level.
Yeah. No, KD's isn't that bad.
And
it's noticeable.
And knowing him as I know him, I don't think he cares.
He probably doesn't, but it's just, I don't know, Craig, part of him's like, wow, that's just Kevin Durant getting up there in years for a basketball player, still a young man, obviously.
Boy, and does he look great in this series.
Yeah, he does.
Play tremendous. Just, that one does. Movie made last night, Kevin Hart was like, whoa, Kevin Durant on the opposite side. Went there and, yeah, he did some things.
I didn't know if KD's bald spot was a thing. So
wow.
Let's go ahead and get to our fun fact of the day. We are 88 days away from kickoff. And, Craig, thinking about an 88 that spent his Texas career while I was on the beat and you called his games, Cedric Reed. I started thinking about Cedric Reed today and Cedric wore 88. And I started thinking about his career is interesting because I just think how different would it have gone for him. Because I think after in his pre-draft process, there seemed to be injury after injury that crept up, surgeries he put off, and it all really just kind of came to a head through that pre-draft process, and that's why. I mean, he's had a cup of coffee in the league. He was the Dolphins for a little bit, and I think he spent a season on the Bills practice squad. So a player that the league found value in, and he was actually doing really well in the XFL before COVID caused that thing to shut down. But I think back to, you know, Craig, Cedric Reed's junior year. You go back to that 2013 season. This is still a wild just note for me. One of only two players in the FBS in the 2013 season with at least 5 sacks, 4 pass breakups, and 5 forced fumbles. Do you remember who the other FBS player that had at least 5 sacks, 4 pass breakups, and 5 forced fumbles was in 2013?
Who was in?
How about Khalil Mack?
Khalil Mack.
At Buffalo.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so Cedric Reed, 2-time All-Big 12 guy, had just that outstanding game against West Virginia. 13 tackles, 4 tackles for loss, 3 sacks, and a win over West Virginia his senior year. And I mentioned Cedric Reed's a good 88 to go with because this is something else we talked about on the Blitz podcast today. Even in the lean years, we talk about the NFL draft, starting with the 11 draft coming off of the 10 season through the last decade, how lean the draft has been for Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're talking about draft or free agency, Craig, this program has still not had a problem producing quality defensive linemen. Now, some of these guys have shifted to hybrid roles or straight-up linebackers. These are your draft picks starting with the 11 draft, really through the most recent draft. Sam Acho, Keyston Randall, Alex Okafor, Malcolm Brown, Hassan Ridgeway, Charles Omenihu, Joseph Osai, Taquan Graham. And some of those guys have gone on to be really good pros.
Mm-hmm.
And Alex Okafor, Malcolm Brown, those guys have Super Bowl rings. Charles Omenihu, probably going to start down in Houston this year. Hassan Ridgeway, was a big part of the Eagles' defense last year until he got hurt. Sam Acho, no longer in the league, but was a really productive player while he was there. And then you start getting into the free agent. Cedric Reed, again, is a guy that's had a cup of coffee in the league. So did Jackson Jeffcoat. Jackson Jeffcoat, his claim to fame, I think his first and maybe his only NFL sack was against Tony Romo.
Yeah.
So he's actually carved out a really nice career for himself in Canada. Canada's one of those places that if you want to play football, there's a place for you. The first couple years can be a struggle, but if you get used to it and you like it,
you adapt, you can flourish.
You can make a nice living up there, and he's done that. Chris Whaley got a cup of coffee with the Cowboys, was with them for a few years. The injuries kind of mounted up, and last I heard he was back in Madisonville at his alma mater coaching. And then, obviously, the two most recent Longhorns that have taken the undrafted free agent, Puna Ford, who just got a nice new contract with the Seahawks. And then Malcolm Roach making a roster as an undrafted free agent in the toughest year to make a roster as an undrafted free agent. So, Cedric Reed celebrating 88 days until kickoff. This program, again, even in the lean years, still really good producing defensive line talent.
Okay, so would it be safe to say normally that'd be a good note to have for the notebook, but we've got an entirely different presentation of the notebook this hour.
Yeah, again, it's one of my favorite pieces that comes out in the 24/7 Sports Network and the family every year. It's Chris Hummer's development rate piece, and rather than me try to sit here and break it down, I figured we'll just bring Chris on and have him go through the nitty-gritty of how he came up with this.
That'll be next when we continue with Light the Tower on the Horn, 104.9, 101.9, AM 1260, viewable by those of you watching on Twitch. We're live, local, and digital on the Horn app and at hornfm.com. This is what the texter was asking about Jeff Howe, if he was now capable of doing this.
No. I turn my microphone on and maybe I'll do some professional radio today.
Because he had done the hustle to get in the studio, so they wanted to know if he could kung fu fight.
Did the same guy do both songs?
No.
No.
Okay. No.
So it's just a 70s joke that went over my head?
Well, no, I just wanted to, it was right around the same time,
okay.
74 and 75, that kind of thing.
It's a vibe.
Yeah,
there I got you. Okay.
I'll tell you what else is a vibe, the notebook.
Longhorn Notebook, brought to you by Cedar Park Overhead Doors. Go to cptours.com.
And that brings us to a special edition of the Notebook with a special guest.
Yes, let's go to the Vaqueros Cafe and Cantina Hotline. He has published my favorite story to read across the 24/7 Sports Network every year when it comes out because he puts a ton of work into it. He is 24/7 Sports National College Football writer Chris Hummer. His development rate story is out. Chris, thanks so much for taking the time to be on with us today on Light the Tower. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm excited to be with you. I haven't talked to you in a minute, Jeff. I hope everything's good. Excited to be here.
It's been a minute. So before we get into the development rating story and the nuts and bolts of it, what How did you come up with this idea? I know in the off season we're always trying to find, you know, different things to write, and there's all kinds of data and numbers out there. How did you come up, A, with this idea, and then B, crunching the numbers to quantify development rating?
Yeah, I mean, we both work for 24/7 Sports, and we're very familiar with how much fans kind of salivate over top 247 prospects on the message boards. Sometimes you'll get like 20 to 100 thread deep things on just a four-star prospect in the mid-200s that fans are so concerned about. And we spent so much time on that. But I always kind of wonder what schools like do the most with those prospects once they get to campus, because I feel like fans tend to kind of move on once they're there. If they don't perform, they're kind of on the next guy. But I figured there would be a quantitative way to define how schools develop those elite prospects. And I think it is a bit of a misconception. Some people feel like elite prospects are ready to go the minute they get to campus. And that's the case in very rare occasions. But for the most part, those guys need development once they get there. And some schools do it much better than others once they get to campus. And I was just trying to figure out a way to do it, try to figure out a way to measure what schools develop the best. And we kind of came up with development rating, which kind of combines day one, day two, day three draft data with the total number of top 247 players a school produces. And then we kind of crunched the numbers a little bit, and we came to our final tallies.
Yeah, so I think this part is interesting too, Chris, because I think that you're basically, this separates kind of the, you know, the outliers from, okay, how are these, a player that kind of makes it all the way through and can complete their eligibility, did they get developed? Because, and it mentions this in the article, and I love this, and this has actually helped me for anybody that's looked at some of my articles, off-season articles at Horns 24/7. This is what helps me come up with things like bust rate and NFL hit rate using some of this criteria. 24/7 Sports removed four categories of prospects from the data. So you're not even including players who were dismissed, players who didn't qualify, players who medically retired, players who transferred after two or fewer seasons in the program, and there's a way to quantify guys who were in there for year three and whatnot. But so, Chris, this is getting down to brass tacks, right? Once these guys, if you're actually developing guys and they're seeing their eligibility, at least through their draft eligible year, this is really getting down to brass tacks on who can develop blue chip talent and who can't.
Yeah, absolutely. We wanted to focus on prospects who are out of school for a somewhat significant period of time. So as you said, we removed players who are only there for 2 years or fewer. So if you were there, like, you were counted. So you might be a five-star coming in, but if you did nothing, you hurt your school in terms of development rating. And we kind of looked at all that, and unsurprisingly, Alabama was at the top. Mm-hmm. For, I believe, the second straight year in these rankings. People do not give Nick Saban enough credit for his development once they get to campus. They often cite the amount of recruits he brings in, but that program brings so many recruits in largely because the end product is the NFL for that program. And we saw that this past year with the national championship and with Alabama having a historic NFL draft class. So Alabama's at the top, and I'm sure y'all want to talk Texas, which has been a pretty consistent mainstay at the bottom.
Right. 24/7 Sports national football writer Chris Hummer joining us here on Light the Tower on the Horn to talk about his development rate piece. It is a running piece that's updated every year, and the data set used, as I said earlier in the show, for this year's piece is the 2012 through 2016 recruiting cycle. So, Chris, before we get to Texas and Texas A&M, because those are the two schools this year that stand out, obviously, for not so savory reasons. But when I look at this top 10 and you think about the seasons that correlate with these recruiting cycles, two schools really stand out. And when you think about how they did, it really shouldn't. But, and one, I guess, for a good way, and one that's kind of puzzling, Washington coming in at number three. And Miami cracking the top 10 at number six. And Washington, I guess, proves it's more about quality than quantity. And Miami, for all their issues on the field and the inability to really turn the corner and stay there, that's a program, Chris, that still is really good producing NFL talent.
Yeah, with Washington, I first think it's a big credit to Chris Peterson. Obviously retired now. Jimmy Lake's the head coach there. Chris Peterson did a lot with a little during his tenure in Washington. And if you kind of expanded this beyond the top 247, like, Washington would still rank really highly. They've done a great job developing some of those three-star prospects as well. But Washington consistently produced early round draft picks, especially from the secondary, from the top 247. They have a hit rate of over 60%. They're the only team from the Pac-12 to have a draft hit rate with those top 247 guys over 50%. And I think it's a big reason we saw Washington in the college football playoff. Washington remains the only Pac-12 team kind of since Oregon in that first year in 2014 to reach the playoff. And I think if you're looking at a Pac-12 team who might kind of jump out this year, Washington's still a great candidate. People kind of forget about them, but they've developed really well. And the framework kind of remains in place even post-Chris Peterson. With Miami, I think Miami's a really interesting case. Most of Miami's draft picks have come on day three. So that program is bringing those guys in. They're being processed, turned into draft picks, but not really necessarily developed into the elite of the elite. Mm-hmm. But I do think Miami having a draft percent hit rate of over 60%, one of only three teams in the development rating to do so, really shows what Miami can be if that program really gets running. And Manny Diaz is kind of changing a little bit over there. Texas fans very familiar with him. He's doing an excellent job during his tenure in Coral Gables. And that's a program, if they have one or two seasons where they're rolling, that program can really get going, and kind of their draft production shows that.
All right, Chris, let's go ahead and talk about the main reason why this article in this part of the country gets discussed so much every year. Of the 27 qualifying programs in your data set, Texas isn't last this year. It's creeping up a little bit there at 25. As you crunched the numbers and went through all of it, what did you make of Texas in the years with which you studied this data?
Well, Texas can celebrate. They're no longer last. And honestly, it's a pretty significant jump. I think their percent drafted was in the 14s in 2020, and now it's at 28, so it's jumped significantly. Texas really benefited from the 2010 and 2011 classes kind of coming off the books. Those were historically bad. I think if you combine the 2009, actually, I'm going to throw that in there as well, the 2009, 2010, and 2011 draft classes, all of which were top six, Texas had, I believe, one first-round pick, Kenny Vaccaro, and I think like three draft picks overall. It was just a terrible, terrible stretch for Mack Brown in terms of kind of the way they evaluated in a lot of cases. And then when Charlie Strong took over, some of the development that was there with those classes. So when those classes kind of come off the books, things look a little bit better for Texas. And I think moving into the future, they look better as well. Tom Herman, controversial on the way out, but Texas did just have five players drafted in this last draft class. That's the most they've had, I believe, since 2014. So you're starting to see a little bit of progress. But if Steve Sarkisian wants to kind of really take this program to the next level and really truly bring Texas back, it starts with development.
So Chris, kind of knowing what we know about how, you know, this your piece, how it trends from year to year, and as classes drop off and classes get added, not that I don't know if you've gone this far down the road, but when you look at Texas for next year's data, the 2022 data, what it'll say, obviously you'll lose the 2012 class, you'll lose a first-round pick in Malcolm Brown, you'll get to the 13 class, which that did produce a draft pick. Jeff Swain was drafted out of that class, but you'll add the 17 class, and Chris, is it safe to say Texas could move up when you're talking about a class where Sam Ellinger, Taquan Graham, and Sam Cosmi, well, Cosmi won't count, but Ellinger and Graham, well, guys that were drafted, even though they were day three picks, they'll still potentially bump that number up a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I remember that 2017 class correctly, I think there was only like three or four top 247 players anyway. It was a transition class with Sam, Taquan Graham, and I think Tony L. Carter might have been the other top 247 player from that class. Obviously wasn't drafted. But anytime, even if it's a small sample size, a team can produce essentially 66% of their top 247 players drafted. Texas is in position to move up slightly, although losing Malcolm Brown, who you get a lot of points for in our system for being a day one pick, will hurt. But anytime you're kind of raising your overall average, I think Texas does have a chance to move up. And I think that's going to continue to be the case moving forward the next couple of years. Texas is producing draft picks again. And even though a guy like Caden Stearns, looking ahead to 2018, was a bit of a disappointment, kind of as a day three pick, he will still kind of help that total because it's better than some of the busts Texas had in the past.
Right, no doubt. 24/7 Sports national college football writer Chris Hummer joining us here on Light the Tower on the Horn. So, Chris, I was kind of surprised when I looked at the rankings, and I see Texas A&M come in at 26, because the Aggies have had success putting draft picks in the NFL, but when you're talking about top 247 guys, those blue chip guys, and you look at the classes, you know, in this data set, 12 to 16, that's the bulk of what Kevin Sumlin should have done post Johnny Manziel. And when you look at the on-field results, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I think I was a little surprised with the Texas A&M results, but as you said, when you kind of dive into it, it does make sense. We think of Johnny Manziel, we think of Mike Evans, but those guys were three-star recruits. And those guys were kind of the foundation of what Texas A&M had that first season Kevin Sumlin was there, when they kind of caught lightning in a bottle. But as you said, after that, Texas A&M really struggled to produce what they brought in. Obviously, I think Kyler Murray's the best example of that, losing him to Oklahoma, that whole transfer process, goes in to be number one overall. Didn't hurt Texas A&M in the data set, but it's kind of an example of what they lost and what they missed on. And with Texas A&M plateauing around 8 wins every year from like 2013 to 2017, I think it really shows that Kevin Sumlin kind of struggled to capitalize on what he had momentum-wise with Johnny Manziel early in his tenure. And even though he brought in some of those blue-chip recruits, even though there was a lot of hype about Texas A&M's facilities and everything else that was going right with that program at the time, Kevin Sumlin and his staff failed to develop in a way to kind of capitalize on that. And I think that's the biggest indictment on Kevin Sumlin's tenure and is a big reason why he is no longer the coach of Texas A&M.
Chris, when you do these every year, is there something that surprises you, that stands out when you put all of this together every year? And was there one thing that surprised you more than any other?
It's kind of interesting. It's just kind of data. I mean, sometimes the teams near the top surprise me. Ole Miss continually surprises me for being in the top 10 every year, but I have to remind myself they had that historic 2013 class with 3 first-round picks. That's kind of buoying there. But I think one of the interesting things is you can see college football shift in the top 247 data. When you look at the 2010 class, I think maybe there were like 10 or 15 total transfers. So that was the first class I really examined with it's the first year the top 24/7 sports produced the top 247. So maybe 5% of the entire class decided to transfer. When I'm looking at the 2016 data, that number is probably closer to 20-25% already. And I think moving forward, as we see with the transfer portal and transfer portal era, that number is going to start pushing 30-40% of the elite players nationally deciding to transfer at one point in their career. And I just like, that is one thing I notice every year. I just feel like there's more and more players that I have to denote as a transfer as I go on. And it's just completely changing the way the sport works. And it's going to probably change the way our development rating works eventually.
Chris, I'll get you out of here on this. When I look at, you know, kind of the middle is usually where there's some ground for shifting either up or down. And any teams you want to mention as far as teams you see that are going to rise in the study or that you know are going to fall. But when I look at who you've got in the middle, I feel like in the next few years, Clemson will shoot up this list, and we will see Florida State probably take a tumble from 12.
Yeah, Clemson's actually a really interesting program. They were number 3 last year in these rankings, so they actually took a tumble all the way to 11. And Clemson is bringing in more and more elite classes, so they're bringing more and more top 247 players. So it'll be interesting to see how that works. I would imagine they'll jump up, but I think one thing that differentiates Clemson for some of the other top programs is they tend to, process is probably the way to put it. They don't oversign every class, and they tend to kind of hang on to their players a little bit longer until they get their degrees, whereas other programs will kind of cycle players out more aggressively. And I do admit that might be something I have to think about in the rankings, because I think it hurts Clemson more than it does some programs like an Alabama or a Georgia. Looking through, Florida State's certainly in position to tumble.
Yeah.
And Michigan at number 15 in our rankings is actually in position to move up. I know people really kind of dislike some of the stuff Jim Harbaugh's done on the field, but that program is still producing a lot of draft picks. They might not be early round picks, but Michigan, with more of Jim Harbaugh's classes starting to kind of count for these rankings, they're going to continue to move up.
You can get him on Twitter at Chris_Hummer. That's where you can find graphs and data and the article itself. Again, it is my favorite read every year that comes out across the 24/7 Sports Network. It is the development rating story done by Chris Hummer. Chris, thanks for joining us today. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, you probably want to give a pretty big shout out to Christian Corona for helping you with crunching all this data and trying to quantify this.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a huge, huge help for me this year. Christian Corona, if Texas fans aren't familiar, you should go ahead and follow him on Twitter. He is a big Texas fan. He'll get you all informed on everything from softball to Texas football in terms of stats.
Sounds great. Chris, we appreciate you joining us. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah. So, real interesting compilation of things.
And the softball, obviously, Christian's sister, Camille Corona, she's on, absolutely, the softball team.
She had herself.
In case folks couldn't put two and two together.
Yeah. Oh, Dripping Springs.
Yep.
Yep. And she had herself quite the postseason. She played really, really well. All right. We'll be back to wrap up today's edition of Light the Tower here on The Horn, live, local, and digital on The Horn app and at hornfm.com. Our thanks again to Chris Hummer joining us for that real day. You know, you and Rod with the podcast, and Matt, which, by the way, folks can hear tonight, right?
Yes, here on The Horn, 7 o'clock.
You guys do that, the real deep dive stuff, and what we just had there was real deep dive stuff.
Yeah, but it's good stuff. It helps, it helps explain, you know, why has Texas been where they've been the last decade? Well, you look at, you know, development rate, the bust rate Matt and I do, NFL draft numbers, and you look at it when it's been really good, and you look at it when it's been not so good, and it all makes sense.
Yeah.
There's always a way to explain it, to quantify it.
Yeah. So our thanks again, Chris, for joining for this.
Selfishly, Craig, I've kind of made that my mission to quantify things, because there was a time where after about the third or fourth time I asked Tom Herman a question in a press conference setting, and the direct response I got from the head coach was, I don't know, you always want me to try to quantify things. Well, maybe things should be quantified. Maybe we should try to put a number on things to make them make
sense. I don't think
sense.
He liked you trying to put, I mean, he didn't dislike you. He did not like you trying to get him to pin down a certain specific thing.
I knew, I got to know you. And you know this with different coaches, like when you push the wrong button.
Right.
Like
right.
I knew with Tom, when it was a one-sentence answer.
Mm-hmm.
And no retort. I knew he probably didn't want to talk about it. Just move on to something else.
You're kind of, at that point, you're kind of like George Costanza with the soup Nazi and the line there. I didn't get any bread. Let it go.
Yeah, it was.
Didn't get any bread. You want bread? $3.
Like, I remember.
No soup for you.
Camp in 18, right? Yeah. Still got the quarterback battle going on. And it had been a couple practices and anybody asked about quarterbacks, and we're getting towards the end. I can tell, you can usually tell in those settings when you're about to wrap up. You've been going for about 10, 12 minutes. And I just asked Tom, I said, Tom, is there anything you want to mention about either your quarterbacks? He said, nope.
Yeah,
and
I remember that.
Looking around for the next question. I was like, all right, that kind of tells you where he is on quarterback today. So, probably not a good practice for either one of them today.
I'm telling you, it's no soup for you.
You got to pick up. You learn to pick up on the context clues. Read body language, read responses.
That's from being the veteran sage reporter that you are.
I don't know about sage veteran, yes. I've been doing this for a little bit. But.
Okay. All right.
It's weird not being the young guy on the beat anymore. I'm kind of I'm a little bit grizzled now.
I said veteran sage reporter that you are.
Well, damn, I'm on my fourth head coach doing this thing of football.
Nothing says veteran and sage reporter like you're on your fourth head coach.
Jeez. Been a long decade, Craig. Been a long decade.
Yeah. It's fifth for me.
Yeah.
Actually, technically.
Sixth?
Six, because my first broadcast as the analyst was actually the Thanksgiving game in 91 against A&M, which turned out to be David McWilliams' final game. I was subbing for Bill Schoening, who was doing preseason NIT basketball in New York, working with Jerry Trupiano on the broadcast. But they had already kind of made the decision they were going to go with Bill in the play-by-play. They wanted to see if I could pass the test as the analyst. Somehow,
safe to say you passed.
I fooled them at the time. With so it worked colors. Out. Anyway.
It's worked out good for everybody, Craig.
Yeah, we thank you for tuning in. For our man behind the glass, Noom Daniel, our producer, and of course for my co-host Jeff Allen, I'm Craig Way. Stay tuned. Shirts and Skins, Chad and Trey up next. We'll visit with you tomorrow, 10 o'clock, right here on Light the Tower.